Greetings, everybody. I'm Isha Das, the spiritual director of the Assisi Institute in Rochester, New York, and welcome to the podcast series, Wrestling with God. I'm absolutely thrilled to have to be interviewing my friend of over 20 years, John Angelina. Let me tell you a little bit about John. He has been teaching martial arts for over 25 years. He has worked extensively with first responders all over the country, teaching defensive strategies and engaging people. He has multiple black belts, and he has been running a martial arts center here outside of Rochester, New York, in Victor, New York. Is that right, John?
Yeah.
One of his black belts is in jiu-jitsu, and John, why don't you just add, he's also a husband and a father and a deeply spiritual man. I consider John one of my dear friends. I'm not quite sure where we're going to go today, but I'm sure it'll be meaningful and inspiring. John, do you want to add a little bit to my introduction to you?
Well, yeah, I guess I could, just to give a little bit more a background, and really not that the background has any relevance, but because you started, my martial arts background, I started when I was a young man, I think maybe 23 or 24, and I guess I'm 58 now, it's hard to believe, but so it's been 35 years, and 25 of those years has been as a school owner. And yeah, you know, it's like anything else that you do for a long time, that the black belts, they sound extravagant, you know, to people. You know, a black belt, you know, can sound like it's this big grandiose thing. And it's just, maybe it's a sign of my longevity in it, in the different arts that I've done. So I've had so many opportunities to work with so many great teachers and great students. And, we've known each other, I think it's been close to 25 years now, Craig. As far as what I do now, in addition to running the school with my daughter, is we call it Gracie Survival Tactics, and it's first responder courses. So I travel the country for week-long courses, mainly with law enforcement, but also military and some first responders as well. And we teach them the principles and the techniques of jiu-jitsu. And it's such a great art for that, because it involves, de-escalation, physical de-escalation and control, rather than impact, you know, is a first sign of de-escalation, and rather than the striking, and you know, which we've all seen the viral videos that have been so caused such a turmoil, and so it's very rewarding. These guys and gals are very receptive and very appreciative of all that they're learning, and they give just as much back, and they're out there, you know, doing the tough work and trying to keep order. You know, with them, we try to give this protect and serve is the mantra that we talk and we try to kind of move forward, rather than the law enforcement. The law enforcement is controlling and protecting, where the protect and serve is I feel is the kind of the ideology that most law enforcement men and women initially got into this field for.
That's great. So why don't you, we'll start here, John. Tell me why, as a young man, you got into martial arts. What was the attraction? Let's start there.
Yeah. You know, it's changed over the years, meaning that, you know, why I thought I got into it as a young man, it has changed. I think when I was young, I just thought it was cool. I remember as a boy is when the Kung Fu series was out, you know, with David Carradine traveling through the desert. And I just thought that was just cool. The self-defense piece of it, that being able to protect yourself. I was a small kid. And so looking back, maybe that had something to do with it. It never really had to do with beating anybody up, but more self-defense. But I'll tell you, as I got older and just more thoughtful and more experienced and had my own kids and stuff, one of the reasons that I believe that I really gravitated toward that was that I didn't really have a father figure. I didn't have a father figure. I had men in my life, but that series, that Kung Fu series, if you remember, the actor David Carradine was traveling through the desert, but he had a history with his master, which was this, I forgot his name now, but that's what I sought. I wanted that connection with a male figure in my life. And even to this day, Craig, I think that is what I seek. I like that, maybe because I didn't have it, maybe just because I connect with that. And that's not to say that I don't have amazing relationships with younger people or women, because I do. But I think that's what, kind of looking back, drove me into, you know, the internal reasons for me trying to study the martial arts.
All right, so I have two responses. The first one's a quick one. I started when I was in my early 20s. I got into some karate to local dojo and started to take lessons, and I blew my knee out, and I had to quit. I didn't blow my knee out with the karate, but playing football, actually. So I decided I had to quit. But one of the things that always struck me when I was given a manual for the martial arts when I first started, the line went something like this, that if and when you achieve your black belt, if you're the same person that you were when you started, then you really didn't earn a black belt. The translation that is that it's not just about getting the black belt and being able to protect yourself, but it should shape you as a human being. It should make you different and better. And that always just, I've never forgotten that, obviously. The second thing that I think we can really delve into is, tell me from your experience, and I'll share some of my experience afterwards, why having that relationship with a male mentor, father figure, why that's important, why that was important for you, and why do you generally think that's important for men?
Mm-hmm. I think for me, the again, looking back on it now, I didn't have my father passed away when I was 7 years old. My mother and father were divorced at the time. So we were kind of on our own at that point too. I have two younger siblings and my mother, we lived in a small apartment. And I remember when this happened, and there's certain parts of it that I literally remember, you know, like yesterday. And I remember praying to God that, please wake me up from this dream, fully believing that it could happen, you know, at 7 years old. And of course, it didn't happen. So that was, you know, looking back at that, Craig, that was a time that I started to doubt the validity of God from my perspective. And so I feel like I just was searching. You know, I wanted that, partially because I didn't have it. It was taken away from a seven-year-old. So when something's taken away, I feel like at that age, you just want it. And so I was looking around and I was seeing my friends that had, you know, fathers in their lives, and, you know, knowing that, I'm just mad at God because he wouldn't wake me up from this, or wouldn't magically, you know, have this be a dream, and or have my father appear. I mean, fully believed in miracles, and at that age, a miracle to me could happen. Yeah, even if it was to make a deceased person come back to life in some way, you know. So, and then I was just a, you know, kind of a crazy kid. I mean, you know, it's so hard when you're defining yourself, you know. I don't know, relative to all the other kids, but I wasn't a bad kid. I got in some trouble, but nothing hurting other people. Just kind of some, you know, just, gosh, I don't even know, like stealing some things. You know, the kids, we would like throw eggs at cars. But, you know, looking back, I mean, was that because I didn't have a father? I don't know. I feel like, you know, I feel like that, and maybe I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but because I didn't have a father, I was almost using that as a reason, maybe, you know, for kind of doing whatever I wanted. And then when I got old enough to have children and to get married, I do remember that I just wanted to have, I wanted my kids to have the things that I didn't have. I wanted to have a family that I didn't have. And so if you would have asked me back then, I probably wouldn't have described it as then. But looking back, I can see the need for the security that I felt would come from having a family.
All right, so I'm going to introduce a term, and I think it's in the spirit of what we're talking about. It's father hunger. And I think that there are a lot of men that have father hunger. And let me just share a little bit of my own story. It somewhat parallels your story. I had a father. He didn't die. My mother died when I was 12, but my father was a severe alcoholic. And he really couldn't organize and live his own life in any meaningful way. And he couldn't help me to organize my life in any meaningful way. So when I was 14, 15, 16, my life really went south. I dropped out of high school. I hung around a really bad neighborhood. And in hindsight, there was a part of me that was, A, looking for a family, but also looking for a male mentor, father figure who could help me figure life out. And I actually started to go down a very wrong path. There was a local guy who part of this neighborhood, probably about 10 years older than I was at the time, who literally was in the local Rochester mob, who kind of took me under his wing a little bit. But I saw that my life was really going south with him and that whole lifestyle. I won't get into how I broke away from it, but I've just been keenly aware in my own life and in working with other men, this need for, again, calling it father hunger, a man who can kind of initiate you into manhood, teach you what it means to be a man, and empower you to be a man for others. I don't know if that relates at all to what you're talking about.
I can see the similarities in that. Yes. Yeah.
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 And you were drawn to the martial arts, you're saying, in part because you saw the potential to belong to something, but also to get some of the mentoring from an older man that would kind of initiate you into this thing called manhood.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that definitely played a part in it. The other thing is that I foresaw myself being a person of authority to a degree, and not in an overarching superior way, but as somebody who people could look to for protection or guidance or counsel, or you know, something like something that sounds like that. And so I felt that by being somebody who had gone through a relatively arduous task of years of training, you know, that I could be perceived as that. So I think, you know, it goes back to maybe seeking the approval of others, which I'm aware of that, and I kind of fight against that, you know, with the ego. But I look at it a little bit differently now, Craig. My definitions of things are a bit different. So, but that certainly was a drawing feature to me of the martial arts. You know, I remember there was a time right when I walked into the school of the dojo, they call it, the first time. There had been weeks before that I had thought about going into the military as a 23-year-old and a father of two at the time. So, but that was just too big of a jump. That was leaving my family, but I was just looking for something that would make me fit in, feel good, and be part of something bigger than just me and my life.
All right, so see if I'm in the ballpark with you, and I don't want to kind of impose my paradigm on you here. Again, I'm going back to this theme of father hunger. And I think a lot of young men are looking for what you were looking for. First of all, a place to belong, something that would give you strength and legitimate authority, and a way to empower yourself to take care of your family, your loved ones, and to be somebody who could then help and mentor other young people. I guess where I'm going with that is, in our present culture, and maybe we will go down this path, maybe we won't, it's almost like being a man, and what it means to be a man, A, is very confusing, and it's almost maligned sometimes by the culture. Does that make sense?
It does, yes.
You know, when I was 16, halfway through, I was 16 and a half, I actually went to live with a foster family, and I'm still very close to them to this day. They're well into their 80s. But my foster father, he didn't have a black belt in karate, but he was a man's man. Mm-hmm. And two things, I knew we had an instant bond, and I knew he loved me and cared about me, but he also became the first significant authority in my life that I trusted. And he held me accountable. He encouraged me, held me accountable. I remember I went out for the track team one year, my junior year in high school, and I was going to quit after 3 weeks because I wasn't very good at through the discus. I wasn't very good. I was discouraged. And I came home and I announced that I was going to quit. And he really treated me like I was one of his own sons. And he looked at me and said, "No, my son is not going to quit anything. If you quit track, you'll quit in life. You cannot quit." And it was like, whoa. But I knew he was right. And even though I didn't like it, didn't feel good, it helped to shape me and form me and make me the man I am today, one of those moments. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. You know, that makes me think of, I heard a talk by a Bishop Richard Barron. I think I sent you a link to it.
Yes.
But this was actually a different talk that I heard him do. And he said something interesting. He was talking about, you know, today's the youth today. And, you know, he said, in this generation, it's often touted as freedom to be able to decide your own path in life, and that everything is up to you. And, you know, from your sexuality to your behavior around others, your treatment of others. And that's a sign of freedom. It's being touted as a sign of freedom. And, you know, he mentions, which I think it was a great kind of segue into one of his childhood just kind of idols was Bob Dylan. And he quoted Bob Dylan's song saying, "You got to serve somebody."
Yes.
And I really feel like we have to serve somebody, and in serving somebody, how you want to define body, we can talk about that, but serving is the ultimate sign of freedom in my mind. Yeah. And Craig, I believe that with every cell of my body right now, serving a being, and serving in my being is God. Serving is the greatest freedom. And that's a truth that I just know. It's an absolute truth to me.
No, I really like where this is going, John. You know, I've made my living, I'm retired now as a psychotherapist, and been teaching meditation and Kriya Yoga now for a long, long time. And one of the truths that I have stumbled on, and I think it's the same thing that you're saying, or I shouldn't say stumbled on, have discovered and nurtured, is that a good life, a truly good life, isn't about pursuing happiness for the sake of happiness, but a truly good life is mentoring others, it's serving others, it's serving something larger than yourself. It starts, for me, like you, with serving God, but through my relationship with God, serving other people and being helpful in whatever way I can. And I really think that that is what a meaningful life really is. It's what a rich life is. If we pursue happiness for the sake of happiness, it's like a dog chasing its tail. You never quite get there. That happiness is the unintended consequence of a life well lived, but particularly a life of service, again, serving God and serving others. And just to bring this back to what it really means to be, I think, a healthy, life-giving man, it is being strong enough and clear enough to help to set boundaries for yourself, and then to help other people set boundaries for themselves. One of the most loving things we can do sometimes is just to say no. Mm-hmm. But it's also then serving them, helping them to be the best person they can be, and to protect them and to help them to feel safe. One of the things that the gifts that I think I have been able to give people, and I'm sure that you've given this with the young people that you've taught martial arts to, and particularly women, is I can be a help in their life, but I keep the boundaries very clear, and I help them to feel safe. Does that make sense?
It does, yes. Yeah. You know, as you were talking about doing happiness for happiness' sake is maybe like a dog chasing its tail. It's interesting because I thought of it as is actually, again, my definition where my mind is right now is that is the ultimate goal, is doing good for good and not for the outcome.
Yes.
And I think it's very normal. It's you know, to have an objective and then think, what is the outcome? How would I know that I've attained that objective? Even if objective is something as kind of hard to describe as a happiness or an emotion. And I think that's, you know, when I think of Jesus saying, turn the other cheek. Well, gosh, when I was young, I took that literally. Like, wait a minute, you're anti-violence. That means you're going to just turn the other cheek and let them slap you again. And I don't look at it like that now at all. Through my readings and prayers, and I look at that now as it's you're turning the other cheek, not because you want that cheek struck too, but because it's not going to change his love for anybody, regardless of what they did for him. You know what? We're going through a little challenge right now with one of our kids, and there's another individual involved with my son, and you know, it's, and I'm aware of how my feelings for my son are, and then how my feelings for this other individual are, and it's just been a great awareness, awakening, maybe for me to think about Jesus saying, love your neighbor as yourself. You know, love God with all your heart, mind, and spirit, but love your neighbor. And man, I smiles because I'm like, okay, right? It's easy for me to tolerate my son and have conversations and still love him. But how about this other individual that on the surface I can shift the blame to? But what an opportunity to be like, no, I love this individual just as much. And at first it may be words, but words lead to thoughts, and thoughts lead to actions. And so I'm able to look at situations like this now more and more introspectively, and step back with them and talk to and have conversations with you know, friends like you, and that's where I feel that I'm enjoying this human being life more now, because I'm doing things for the sake of doing them and not just for the outcome.
Again, so many little directions I can go based on what you said. One of the things you said is very subtle, but it's very important. Like, you enjoy our friendship. One of my favorite things is when you and I meet for breakfast and we talk. And again, I'll just bring this back to the issue of manhood, that, and it's something I think that we have lost with the Industrial Revolution and modern life. But good men need the company of other good men. I know when I spend time with you, or I spend time with my foster father, or I have some wonderful spiritual male friends, I spend time with these good men. Everything gets a little simpler on the inside. Everything gets a little clearer. and it's more straightforward. And I feel more and more empowered then to be a good man with my wife, to be a good man with all the people I mentor, to be a good man with my sons and my stepchildren. So there's something about men coming together with other good men that it tends to be missing in our society. But it's such a healthy and necessary and empowering thing.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's healthy and necessary.
Yes.
And it's almost a little bit, you know, you got to kind of step back and say, why do we even have to kind of explain that now?
Yes.
But you do, because, you know, you have to kind of, you got to talk about what's, you know, and current events and things like that. But, you know, I think you and I talked about this at our last meeting, though. There can be a lot of goods. And because I say it's good for me to have relationships with men, that's not saying that it's not good for me to have relationships with women. Or, you know, I think you and I, we were kind of like tongue in cheek talking about Biden and Trump. Like, you can agree with both of them or you can disagree with both. But we're in this comparison mindset where everything's competition and comparison. And it's my team versus your team or my party versus your party. And, you know, I think we almost have to go through that in order to get out the other side and realize how that's maybe first grade thinking. And where we are now is maybe, you know, we're at the high school level now and we're just aspiring to be in, you know, to go and get our college degree and our PhDs and move on from there. So I 100% agree. And I'll never apologize for seeking the friendship and counsel of other men, because I do the same thing with women. And honestly, Craig, there are benefits for me personally for both.
Yes.
But I don't even look at it as men and women. I think, you know, I feel like there's times where I seek a man or I seek a woman, but I don't even go there like, oh my, you know, is this the appropriateness? We're men for a reason. We have certain characteristics and attributes that we bring to the world, and women have the same thing. And there's some similarities and there's some identical qualities that we bring. And there's other things that God gave us to bring to this world too. So it's all good.
So let me say this. If somebody said to, somebody asked me to define you in two words, these would be my two words, that John is, and see how this resonates with you and where you want to go with it. I would say that John is a spiritual warrior. Tell me how that fits or doesn't fit, or what that means to you. And I mean that in a positive way. Let me just qualify it a little bit. There's two ways that we can function as a warrior. There's obviously the overly aggressive, destructive, violent warrior. But then there's the noble warrior who stands for principles. There's a noble warrior who protects the people that he loves. And women can have a warrior spirit too. But the spiritual warrior is, again, somebody who stands for principles. They are selfless. They serve. They protect. And there's a kind of clarity and strength that they have. So anyways, I always think of you as a spiritual warrior. And I think I've said this to you before. If I ever had to be in a foxhole with somebody, you would be at the top of the list. But how does that term strike you? How does it fit? How does it doesn't fit? How it doesn't fit, if it doesn't?
Yeah. Well, this, like many of the other things we've been talking about today, has changed over the years, because you did mention that to me probably 20 years ago. And when you first said it, you know, it gave my ego a little boost, you know, because that's what I do. I do martial arts and, you know, I try to help people protect themselves. And but over the years, that definition, that moniker that you use has changed for me. And I'm honored, because where I think you meant by it was literally a spiritual warrior.
Yeah,
someone who
absolutely.
Is, yeah, someone who can strengthen other spirits. And I feel like can only strengthen others when you have a certain amount of strength. And that doesn't mean that I'm at the pinnacle of that. It's something that I'm always kind of working on. You know, identity, knowing our identity is something that I put a lot of thought in over the last couple of years. And I've spoken to you about Jamie Winship, and you know, we've become good friends, and I know you two will definitely all three of us will talk at some point. But his work in at the Middle East, and you know, he was a police officer in DC for years, and then he went out to the Middle East for, I believe, 27 years, and his identity, he was a militant peacemaker. So two kind of could be contradictory words, but what he would do was take people that were, you know, the militants, these Islamic fundamentalists, and he would introduce them to Jesus in ways that I don't understand, but in very successful ways. Not in a conversion, from a conversion standpoint. He wasn't converting them to Christianity, but he was introducing them to hearing God and hearing about Jesus, or hearing Jesus. So it was very fascinating. And the identity that I feel that kind of I call myself, the identity that I feel was given to me by God before I was ever born, is a guardian of the heart.
That's
beautiful.
I
feel that, Craig, is similar, is that I feel like a guardian. That's what makes me feel my purpose is being realized when I'm talking to people and I can make them feel and understand the value that they have to this world, which is ingrained in their heart.
Yes.
And I mean this, and I know it may sound a little bit fluffy, but I really believe everybody has like a beautiful soul in them. And that doesn't mean they're always going to come out. It doesn't mean that, you know, I'm the judger, the person that judges, but it does mean that I feel like through empathy and through a genuine love for people that I'm always trying to refine, it's allowed me to allow people to see the love in their own heart and protect their heart above everything else. And I've had the opportunity to work with, you know, in women's shelters and with kids and with adults and just friends, you know, just guys like you and I that need to be heard, that know that it's okay to talk about these things and to be heard. So I feel like I'm on this, and I don't mean this in a self-serving way at all. I just feel like I'm on this beautiful path because of what God has shown me and allowed me to go through these challenges and put people like yourself in place. You know, and I could tear up now because I feel such a joy that I've had this opportunity, and I just see it continuing, you know, for as long as I'm around.
Oh, John, it's wonderful. So let's go down this path. We're talking about it, but let's go directly. Tell me about how your spirituality and your sense of God, how that shapes your life, how that impacts you, how you draw from that. And I'll just quickly say something about myself. Whatever level of sanity I have in my life, I say this to people, whatever level of effectiveness I have in my life, success, it really springs from my connection to God. It's the foundation. So I'm curious, tell me about your spirituality, your sense of God, and how that informs you.
Yeah. Well, I spoke earlier about how, you know, I had prayed for my father to come back and to take this pain away, and that didn't happen. And so for years, you know, let's just say 10 years after, you know, maybe up to 16, 17, 18, my definition of God was just based on, you know, it was very, it was like a first grader in Sunday school. You know, I was telling a friend that, you know, I have about as much understanding of the Bible as a first grade Sunday school person, because, and it's getting better. But I lived with that for a long time. I didn't expand. I didn't learn more. I wasn't in the church. We had sporadic instances with my mother and stepfathers in churches, but that led to some, you know, very questionable relationships within the church, which kind of reinforced that this church is just this made up thing, and you know, this it's this hocus pocus. And but I'll tell you, there was always a yearning that I have, and that's how I can describe it. There was always something saying, John, there's more, you know. And I just, but I went through, you know, being a like a, I don't want to say a devout atheist, but just I was sure in my mind there's no God. This is all science. We're just, you know. And then I went through my agnostic period and then back and forth a little bit, but there was something always drawing me in. And I feel like my definition for God, my understanding of whether there was a God or not was purely had to be empirical. It had to be something that I had to see. I didn't believe in the miracles, you know. And so as I got older, through just so many instances, Craig, through the birth of my children, through the understanding that, you know, we all go through these challenges in pain, and through my belief that these challenges are not, that they don't define me, or they're not proof of God or not proof of God, they're part of the path. I can tell you, even through this, you know, that brief kind of history of my spiritual path, I don't know what finally was the tripwire that made me know that God is there. God is, it's not even a being. It's a one thing that I feel like, and this wasn't a point in time, but when I look at the universe, when I look at the James Webb telescope, for instance, and I see the vastness and the minuscule piece of land that we live on relative to the universe, and then how small we are and insignificant in many ways, I just know. And for a long time, I felt like I had to be able to explain it or convince others for it to be valid to me. And that's not even, that doesn't even enter my mind. I just know. So somebody could say to me, well, how do you know? And I'm okay saying, I just know.
Yeah.
So,
you know, the great psychologist, Carl Jung, I'm a fan of his, somewhat of a student. And this was maybe in the 60s. He was old at this point. It was the last interview they did with him. And somebody asked him this question. He said, the question was, do you believe in God? And he kind of smiled and he said, no, and I kind of got deflated. He said, I don't believe, I know. And I think if, you know, through prayer, through meditation, you reach a place of, in, I call it intuitive certitude. You just know that there's something bigger than yourself, beyond yourself, that is also that you are in, and it's a, you know, it, that there's a relationship there. It's the ground of your being. And you do reach a point where there is this, again, I call it this intuitive certitude. And you know that it's true because it helps to create the best version of yourself. You know, there's a line by Jesus, all men, all people will know that you are my disciples, not because you have a PhD in theology, not because you have, you know, esoteric experiences necessarily. He says, all people, all men will know that you are my disciples by your love for one another. So when I think a person really makes this conscious contact with God, part of how you know it's authentic is it, again, brings out the very best in you. You become the best version of yourself. And let me just tie it a little bit. You mentioned Jesus, something that Carl Jung said, that he said, Jesus, at least in Western civilization, Jesus is the archetype of the soul. He's the archetype of the ideal person. Now, I think Jesus is more than an archetype. I think he lived and I think he lives. And he is present to planet Earth very intimately. But where I'm going with that, and kind of maybe is beginning to tie this whole conversation together, when I look at what an ideal man is and an ideal human being, for me, it all kind of coalesces around the person of Jesus. that he represents the best in all of us and calls us to be our best self. And I think through God's grace, empowers us to be our best self. As you know, I want to just touch on this for a moment. I bring at the Assisi Institute East and West together, and we teach the meditation techniques and some of the and the philosophy of Paramahansa Yogananda. And my point is, Jesus is central in my life, and I see him as being so large that he can work through all people of goodwill. And I think more and more, as our world shrinks, that we have to be able to see this commonality and see the what I call the truth of Christ consciousness permeating all people of goodwill, so on and so forth. But I wanted to stress that because you talked about Jesus, and Jesus always has been very important to me and continues to be. I think just one other thought in relationship to all of this, and this is part of having these good relationships. You know, I have two spiritual, one's a spiritual father, the other one is a spiritual big brother. The spiritual father is Father Richard Rohr. He's a Catholic priest. He's a Franciscan priest. He's got a center, Thomas Merton Center for Social Action and Contemplation in New Mexico. And I also have a Swami in the Hindu yogic tradition. It's like a Catholic monk, Swami Nirvanananda. He lives in Italy. He's like a spiritual big brother. But where I'm going with all of this is I have given both of these men explicit permission to correct me. Because I need to be, a lot of people correct me. My wife has that permission too. But in terms of these male authorities and loving figures in my life, they're the two people that I have explicitly asked and given them permission, because that helps to hold me accountable. And there's a sweet story with Richard. This is maybe, I don't know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. He came and spoke at the Assisi Institute. And afterwards, we were just sharing a cup of coffee. And he said, you know, you're doing really good with this meditation center. I'm very proud of you. And then he said, do I still have permission to correct you? And I said, absolutely. And the same thing with Swami Nirvanananda. I think that's a part of, again, the club of men and the club of good human beings, is that we give each other permission to correct us when we need it. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, I'm curious that what, and it doesn't have to be specific, but what areas would he correct in? I'm very curious of that.
Well, as I'll put it in a specific context, as the Assisi Institute has grown and people respect me, they listen to what I have to say, they treat me as an authority figure, that temptation, I'll say it this way, you know, when you first get into spirituality and all of that and you're a young person, the temptation is sex, drugs, and rock and roll kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But as you evolve, and particularly if you're given some authority, a position of leadership, which is ultimately service, but in the form of leadership, I think the temptation is a kind of an arrogance or pride, where if I were to say it in very colloquial language, you get too big for your britches. And so I just think it's important in that context to be accountable to people. Even within the Assisi Institute, we have a board of directors that I am accountable to. There's just something in that accountability, again, particularly in the context of being successful, taking on responsibility, having students, independent of what the context is, that if you begin to veer one way or the other in a negative way, that you give permission and you're willing to listen to people who will challenge you mm-hmm. and correct you out of love. Because we all have blind spots. Yeah. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Does that make sense?
It does. You know, I remember reading not too long ago a passage in a book, and it said, for self-reflection, think of these two things. Number one, who do you serve? And in my case, who is God and Jesus, but also whose do you serve? WHOSE, whose you serve. And I serve his people.
Yes.
And that's a, you know, a reflection that I can think of when I'm making decisions or I'm having thoughts in my head. You know, it's almost like, you know, the wristband that we used to see out a lot. I don't see it more. It said WWJD. What would Jesus do? And man, that is just a great reminder for me. I talk about that a lot with people. And, you know, I remember when I saw them when I was 25 years old, I was like, come on, this is crazy. This is, you know, to me, it was still like hippies and, you know, to drive around in big vans and that whole movement. But man, it's like, whose do you serve? It's like, if I can remember that in the decisions. So instead of maybe reacting, I take a moment, have a thought, and then respond. What a beautiful react, or what a beautiful way to interact with somebody versus the normal, I think the common way that I used to do was to react. Even if I felt that was the proper way, why not take a moment? Yes. And I think the people that I most enjoy listening to are the ones that I can hear and see by the way they speak, they're reflecting as they're speaking. They're not in such a hurry to get out the words that they're not taking that time to also reflect and respond as they're doing that. So,
well, something Roy Eugene Davis, he's deceased now, but he was a direct disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda. Yogananda died in 1952, and Roy gave me permission to teach the Kriya Yoga meditation technique and to teach the philosophies. But something that Roy said to me once, and I think it's in the same spirit of what you're saying, he said, never forget that you're a spiritual teacher. Now, I don't think he meant pontificate at every opportunity that you get to, you know, to teach and preach. It's not what he meant. What he meant, and I think it's in the spirit of what you're saying, is remember that you're always here in every situation, regardless of what your role is or your title. You're there to serve. You're there to love. You're there to, in a sense, lay down your life. And again, bringing that back to Jesus, that's what he taught. That he said, paraphrasing, but pretty close to a word-for-word translation, no greater love that a man has than to lay down his life for his friends. And I think that that's the ultimate essence of what it means to be a healthy woman, a healthy man, what it means to be a spiritual warrior. So, John, we'll move towards a conclusion. Is there anything you want to say, anything else, any loose ends you want to tie up?
I don't want to end it without just saying a few things about you, because it's your podcast and you bring people on. And, but I think it's important because, Craig, you have done more, you know, and this is another thing I do as I get older, I can tear up and I get very emotional, but it's just because the truth comes out. You've done more than you may ever know in my life, just by being my friend and being my spiritual warrior and just knowing that you're there for not just for myself, but for so many, and watching you at the Assisi Institute and our relationship and how it's changed over the years. It's been a blessing in my life, and it's made me the person that I am and allowed me to have the conversations that I have with others and hopefully, you know, adding value to their life as well. So thank you.
Oh, John, you're very kind. I appreciate that. And I want you to know, I consider you one of my dearest spiritual brothers, and your presence in my life inspires me to be a better person. I'm not just saying that. Every time I think of you, which is often, I don't know, there's like a movement upwards. I get stronger. So I want to thank you because you truly have made me a better person and continue to have a positive influence. And
thank you.
So you know you're a dear spiritual brother, and I love you dearly. So to those of you that are listening, I thank you for listening. I would encourage you, if you like this podcast, give it a like. Please subscribe, pass it on to your friends, or make a comment. We really do listen to them. And John, thank you. God bless you. And I can't wait to see how the next chapters in our friendship unfolds. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you.
All right. God bless.